Broadcasting from the Mono Wind Casino Studios. This is Multicultural AM 1600 KGST Fresno. Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlo Dermagradichin. Today, my guest is Dr. Umit Kurt. He is a Polonsky Fellow at the Van Leer Institute in Jerusalem and an Australian Research Council Fellow. He also teaches at Hebrew University and is joining us today from Jerusalem. Welcome, Umit.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Mugurdichan. Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to congratulate you. You've just had a new book published by Harvard University Press, and the book is called The Armenians of Ein Tab, The Economics of Genocide in an Ottoman Province. So today I wanted to talk to you about the book and about your research about the book. So first of all, just tell us a little bit about the general book. What is the book about, The Armenians of Ein Tab?
Sure. Actually, if you don't mind, I want to start with how the idea for the book originated and tell you a little bit about the research process and share relevant stories of my discoveries over the course of writing my book, which was actually outcome of my dissertation, of course, revised and rewritten. And also I added, I also put additional materials as well. So following my graduation from Middle East Technical University in Ankara, I found myself again at my parents' house in my hometown of Gaziantep, formerly known as Ein Tab, where I escaped the stifling heat and passed the days dozing on the sofa. One day I was jarred from my nap by a call from an old friend. Umit, where have you been? It has been ages. I know a great place in Kayacık where we can catch up, stuff like that. Although I was born and raised in Ein Tab and hadn't left the city until college, the word Kayacık did not mean anything to me. It was just another district in the city, a neighborhood I had never visited, of which I knew nothing, actually. She said she would wait for me at Papyrus Cafe and gave me directions. I took a bus to the Kayacık neighborhood and upon arrival found myself dazed by the charming atmosphere, letting myself get lost in the side streets, and leaving my poor friend waiting some more. Embarrassed by my obliviousness, I found myself asking, where am I? What is this place? So I was on a narrow street with beautifully constructed stone houses lining each side, taking you back to a simpler, though slightly mysterious time, let's say. So tucked away between high-rise concrete apartment buildings of so-called modernized Gaziantep. So this neighborhood was like an architectural mirage. I felt nostalgic for a past that was never mine, let's say. So finally, I found Papyrus Cafe, which turned out to be located in one of those exotic houses. Like most of the houses on the street, it had been converted into a cafe as part of the process of restoring the city. Upon entering, a few letters carved at the top of the majestic gate caught my eye. Not recognizing the script, I simply assumed these were Ottoman characters. Inside, I was once more left speechless. So a spacious courtyard with staircases on either side leading up to two large rooms welcomed me. The rooms were filled with antique furnishings. At the high ceilings were adorned with frescoes and engravings similar to the Florentine cathedrals, let's say. So the experience was kind of a historical voyeurism for me, like stepping into a living museum. Feeling a surge of pride in my hometown and ancestors, I decided to talk to the owner to try to glean some information about the history of the house. I approached him, intending only to compliment his establishment, but before I could stop myself and ask, I was just wondering, from whom did you get this place? Who was here before you? He wearily explained that he inherited this place from his grandfather. It must have been especially strong coffee they were serving that day. So as I was emboldened to press further and ask, and how about your grandfather? From whom did he buy this place? So the man paused hesitantly, before responding. And then after a few moments, he softly murmured to the ground beneath him, "So there were Armenians here." I said, "What? There were Armenians here." And then I said, "What Armenians? What are you talking about? Were there Armenians in Gaziantep?" He nodded. So I was getting annoyed with the opacity of his answers, you know. So I asked, "So what happened to them? Where did they go?" He retorted indifferently, "They left." So as I rode the bus back home, I pondered why the Armenians, why anyone actually, let alone Armenians, would just leave and hand over such an exquisite property to someone. So I was a naive to the point of ignorant 22-year-old university graduate, unaware of the existence of Armenians in my hometown. So a few years later, I would find out that this house in question belonged to Nazar Nazaretyan, honorary consulate to Iran, who was a member of Aintab's wealthiest and most prominent family, and that he, his children, and his grandchildren used to live in this house. Those letters above the gate were not Ottoman, but Armenian, spelling out the surname of Kara Nazara, so the Black Nazara, who built the house. So years later, I would also have the chance to meet the youngest member of the family, Shushan, whose grandmother was deported at the age of one during the 1915 Armenian genocide. Shushan kindly spoke Turkish to me in Aintab dialect when I was in Boston. Hence, that building is no longer Papyrus Cafe for me. So for me, it's the house of Nazara, the Nazaretians, from the house where the grandmother of dear Shushan was born. Therefore, the houses in Kayacık are the homes of the Barsumyans, Prenyans, Aşçıyans, Kıraçıyans, Leylekyans, Cebeciyans, and Karamanukyans for me. In Turkish, you know, there's a saying, mal sahibi, mülk sahibi, hani bunun ilk sahibi. Roughly translated, it reads landlord, property owner, and where is the original owner? So this book is the story about, this is the story about how the idea to work on this topic and write a book out of it came out. So this is the book, is the story of the Aintab Armenians who were torn away from their homes, neighborhoods, and the city where they were born and raised. So this is the account of how their material and spatial wealth changed hands and was transformed. So the book is the historical record in that sense of their persecution and subsequent erosion.
You were able to find then individual properties for individual Armenian families. Where did you find that information, or where in your research?
Actually, that has to do with another relevant story of my discovery, which is the following. So while doing my archival research for this book, a fantastic incident happened to me. Over the course of my research, I was searching for the report and records of Abandoned Property Liquidation Commissions and its Aintab branch, Aintab Abandoned Property Liquidation Commission. This commission was founded by the Ottoman ruling government then, the Party of Union and Progress, and in charge of liquidating and selling Armenian movable and immovable properties in the public auctions after their forced deportations during the genocide period. And the government kept entire records of these sales and other transactions of these commissions. By the way, we are talking about almost 34, 35 commissions established in different and various districts and provinces in Asia Minor. So over the course of 1.5 years research in the Ottoman archives in Istanbul, I could not manage to obtain records of these commissions, including its Aintab branch, as they were kept hidden and inaccessible for researchers. So these records were essential for my book in order to document the so-called legal theft and plunder and liquidation of Armenian wealth in a local place. I had felt desperate back then. In the meantime, it was in 2015, I paid a visit to Los Angeles to meet a friend of mine who was a descendant of genocide survivor, late Pakrat Kazazyan, may God rest in peace, from Aintab. So Uncle Pakrat, I used to call him like that. Uncle Pakrat was rather supportive of my work since we have met. He wanted to introduce me his cousin, whose grandfather, Sarkis Yakubian, from Aintab, and survived the genocide by ending up in Aleppo and opening up a bakery over there. Uncle Pakrat took me to her house. It was a quite warm welcoming. So after a lot of night chats and having delicious food, Pakrat's cousin brought dozens of old papers, documents, all written Ottoman Turkish, and put them in front of me. She was basically trying to help me and thought that there might have some documents which could be useful for my research. The documents and papers were not organized. I start to look at them. While getting lost amongst them, all of a sudden my hand went to all papers and I started to cast a gaze on them. The more I looked at and read them, the more I got thrilled. Having read the first page, I realized a report of Aintab Liquidation Commission was standing in front of me. And I was reading auction results regarding the movable properties, assets, and goods of her grandfather, Sarkis Yakupyan. What the documents were telling me was so groundbreaking, because what I found was really crux of the matter and proved and documented what an institution known as Aintab Abandoned Property Commission, an official state institution, did to the wealth and properties of a deported Armenian. So it blatantly showed and proved the plunder and spoliation under the veil of legality. That's why it's a first of its kind. Such a document will be revealed and manifested in my book. I had found what I had been looking for years in the Prime Minister Ottoman archives in Istanbul. So the documents I found concerning Sarkis Yakupyan was path-breaking and eye-opening in order to demonstrate what kind of policies Ottoman state and its bureaucrats applied to the properties of deported Armenians during the genocide. So to date, such kind of documentation has not been done, but this book manages to do so.
So you were just fortunate in a sense to come across those, because they happened to give you those, but have you been able to locate any other source for those? In other words, where is now those documents, or are they still around?
So as you know, as the relevant archives, the archives of the Land Registry and Kadastro in Turkey are closed. So I walked Gaziantep's old Armenian neighborhood street by street and interviewed the inhabitants of the city, as well as relatives of Aintab Armenians from diaspora. In doing so, I also tried to obtain title deeds from those Armenians in diaspora in order to determine which buildings they used to own, as well as the previous and present day Muslim owners. As a result of this research, I made a list of properties and their locations along with their previous and present day owners. So I pinpoint more than 450 locations, and I indicated its trajectory, the timeline, you know, the first owner, second owner, third owner, and all the way leading up to current owner. I also use a number of Armenian memoirs and also primary archives from the Armenian National Archives and Azgain Grataran, as well as local sources written in Turkish, which are available in Aintab's local libraries. So these sources are quite helpful for me to pinpoint the locations of these properties and their current owners.
So specifically, what happens is that this liquidation commission then, since the Armenians were gone, they would say that these properties are available now, they would put them up to auction, and then those would be registered in the names of the new owners. In other words, the property would be registered in the names of the new owners.
Exactly. That, you know, it's extremely difficult to document this this transaction of any liquidation commission, because their records are inaccessible. So these liquidation commissions work the following way. They used to work the following way. First of all, they kept the notebooks of those records, auction results, auction notebooks, and also the notebooks for accounts and so on and so forth. These notebooks, one copy of the notebook was kept by the president of each and every liquidation commission. Another report was supposed to be sent to the Minister of Interior, and another report was supposed to be kept by the General Secretary of Union and Progress Party in the relevant province, İttihat ve Terakki Katibi Mesulü. So we are talking about, imagine 34, 35 liquidation commissions in different provinces and districts, and you should multiply this with three, because we are talking about three copies. So what we are talking about is more than 100 copies of each and every liquidation commission. And these reports show how movable properties of Armenians who were subject to deportation decision were sold out in auctions. And in this report, the most striking aspect of these reports is that you can see who acquired, who bought those, who purchased those properties. So you could see those names, you know. And in my research, thanks to Sarkis Yakup, thanks to, you know, Sarkis Yakupyan's granddaughter, I obtained this document, and I demonstrated and also documented how his mobile properties, including scissors, forks, you know, ashtrays and plates and jewelries, you know, all his bones were situated in Ottoman, Aintab branch of Ottoman Bank, and so on and so forth. They were all sold out in auctions, and these auctions were led by Tevfik Bey, who was the president of Aintab Liquidation Commission. He was also involved in purchasing. He also purchased, even though it was forbidden, you know. And there was also, I want to also draw your attention to this dual track mechanism. On the one hand, there were legal mechanisms, but on the other hand, there was looting, plunder, and also legal mechanisms were not fulfilled by the authorities who were supposed to, you know, apply those rules and regulations. That's the reason why when you look at the archives, you will see number of documents from the central government sending ciphered telegrams to presidents of the liquidation commissions, telling them and ordering them, please do this in a legal way, do this in a proper way, because the state needed those properties, you know.
So, but then the local officials were the ones that were managing it, and that's when the corruption or the they're selling to themselves or to their friends would take place.
Exactly. That is what was happening on the ground at the localities. And when you see who purchased those properties, you will see how economic and political interests converge. This is one of the important aspects of my book. I try to show how political and economic interests came together and overlap. And also, when you see who were the who purchased those properties, these people were mostly local elites, provincial notables, and they were founders of Aintab Union and Progress Party Club, and they were members of this political organization in the city. And that's why they got hold of the lion's share.
And this would have been the provincial. So Aintab, tell us which province Aintab was in, and where was the governor located, and who were the high ranking officials perhaps in the area?
You know, Aintab was situated like 50 miles away from Aleppo, and Aintab was a district in 1915, and it was a district and linked to province of Aleppo. So each and every decision regarding deportation, regarding property, abandoned property commissions and abandoned property liquidation commissions, these decisions and orders from the central government were valid for Aintab too. So Aintab had a district governor. The first district governor was Mehmet Şükrü Bey, who was at odds with deportation. And then Talat was not content with what he was doing, and Talat replaced him with Ahmet Faik Ernet, who was an overarching, you know, supporter of deportation. So actually, he was the one who also convinced Talat Pasha to deport Aintab Protestant Armenians too in the city. That's why Protestant Armenians were deported in Aintab in late December 1915.
So the CUP members then, the heads of the political party, they must have also been discussing then, in addition to the elimination of the Armenians through deportation, they must have already been thinking about the economics of this. That is, who was going to take over their houses, businesses, properties, and such, right?
Exactly. It's, you know, they play a huge role in actually persuading central government to take the deportation decision for Aintab. So that's why I pay particular attention to the local dynamics of genocide. You know, its political, social, and economic legacies, and the roles of local actors and the civilian and military authorities, by combining Armenian and Turkish documentation as well as employing unmined Armenian and Turkish sources. So doing so enables me to demonstrate the complex picture of not only the relations between central and local actors, but also each group's internal relations. So the book therefore brings together analysis at the micro level, contextualizing the genocide in a global and national context, and the meso level, revealing and discussing the activities of the various middlemen of violence, notables, mid-ranking officers, and tribal leaders. And finally, the micro level, dissecting how the process unfolded in the various regional microcosms, an approach that has been missing in the literature, actually. So the book also provides new insights on the causes and origins of genocidal policies and their impact in the making and remaking of provincial elites and by extension of modern Turkish Republic. The striking, the most telling aspect of Aintab in all these, in the genocide literature or in the literature of Armenian genocide is that local actors, these provincial notables, were much more fervent, zealot, enthusiastic, and willing than the central actors, you know, to deport Armenians, because here economic acquiring economic wealth and prosperity and the assets of Armenians play a key role in this process. But I'm not arguing that was the only reason why they got involved in this process. But economic motivation was much more obvious and also standing out in this picture.
My guest today is Dr. Umit Kurt. He is the author of a new book that we're discussing called The Armenians of Aintab, The Economics of Genocide in an Ottoman Province. We're going to take a brief pause on all things Armenian and we'll be back in just a moment.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlow Demirgardichyan. My guest is Dr. Umid Kurt. We're discussing his new book called The Armenians of Ayn Tab. And we were talking about, and you were mentioning this idea of microhistory, and I'd like to explore that a little bit for our listeners because it is now a new area of history. So can you compare it at the approach of microhistory as opposed to other traditional approaches to history and why that's so important in this case?
Micro, as you know, it's the Carlo Ginzburg, you know, he's the founding father of microhistory. And his main idea, and which is always ringing in my ear, is that, you know, in order to make an overriding argument or overriding explanation, or in order to have a explanation which is, you know, a great deal of power to elucidate the subject matter, you should focus on you should dig into, you know, localities, provinces, districts, micro level, you know, studies and small tiny incidents, micro level incidents, in order to arrive an overriding and argument or create some general patterns. Of course, when we talk about Armenian genocide, we are using certain patterns. We have conventional and mainstream proclivities in order to explain what happened to Ottoman Armenians, but this collective violence, this mass violence, did not take place at the same, you know, impact and at the same, you know, so the extent of what happened to Armenians varied from region to region, province to province, district to district. So that's why, you know, actually, in order to flourish the Armenian genocide literature in particular and the Armenian studies in general, we need that kind of studies in order to see how the relationship between not only central and local actors, also the relation and internal dynamics among those actors. That offers us a fresh perspective on the local dynamics of genocide and its political, social, and economic legacies, you know. So that's why my book is more than just a case study. It does not solely add further detail to what is already known, or substantiate a pattern with which we are familiar, as I have just pointed out, give or take some regional variation. It uses specificities to reflect on and reshape our knowledge of the wider whole. So that's why I gave huge importance of micro-level studies, not ignoring or oversighting the importance of the big picture. So the book does not just look at the local dynamics of genocide and community reformation, but also considers the evolving, mutually informing relationship of the metropolitan power center to its regional periphery, and thereby revealing a very significant locus of agency amongst regional elites. So that's why the book's inclusion of micro-level examination of expropriation and plunder at the local level resonates with exploring the beneficiaries of Aryanization.
Well, let me ask you a question now. You, in your book, you did the research as to the people who were purchasing these properties. So can you make a connection to today? Are many of the wealthiest Turkish families in Ayn Tab, do they have their roots going back to that enrichment coming from the genocide?
Yeah, we can say so, because this rising elite of newly established regime, the Turkish Republic, early Turkish Republic, they gained power and legitimacy through the cleansing of the Armenian community and spoliation its property. So there was this tacit partnership. The tacit partnership in crime highlights the economic motives prevalent in almost three decades of violence faced by the minorities around the turn of the century. So these provincial elites and local notables, they constitute the local bourgeoisie of the city. And they also constitute the first startup capitalists of the city. And then their economic privileges also found their expressions in the political arena, because these well-known local elites they also became parliamentary members of the Republican People's Party, those elites. And like İnce, İnceoğlu, Alevli family, Dayı family.
So in a sense, they divorced themselves from the connection to the old regime, but became new players in the Republican regime based on that enrichment which they had. But also there's, again, the ideological, which was for the new nationalism, right, of Kemal Atatürk's Turkey.
Exactly, exactly. For instance, once the deportations began, this gentry, Aintab gentry, they were well positioned to appropriate Armenian goods, properties, and businesses, either directly or via the good offices of the abandoned property commissions or liquidation commissions, indirectly through the state. Also by taking up the cause of the CUP, Union and Progress Party, and ethnic Turkish nationalism, the leading families of Aintab, including Cenani, Mennanzadeh, Tahçizadeh, Istrapzadeh, Daizadeh, Battalzadeh, Hacıazadeh, they secure their control over the local CUP organization and parliamentary representation for the city. So these individuals were far from the only beneficiaries, direct perpetrators of the massacres, often had their own pecuniary motives, weaving the entirety of the process. The function of appropriation was as important as the individual purposes. So huge numbers of people, they were bound together in a circle of profit that was at the same time circle of complicity.
Turkish officials, or not just officials, but you mentioned one person, I think, but how many were there that actually were opposed to this taking place or in some way resisted? I'm talking about Turks. Were there those that you came across in your research who were opposed to this whole process and didn't participate in it where they could have, perhaps?
Actually, from the local population, I haven't encountered anyone or any example, frankly speaking. But I came across a few bureaucratic, civil and military bureaucratic elites who were opposed to this process, who were opposed to deportation and then following spoliation and also theft, who were opposed to that. But these people, some of them resigned and some of them were replaced with, you know, other bureaucrats who were prone or who were ready to, you know, fulfill the orders of the central government. So that's why, you know, actually the real issue is that there were so many local, let's say, elites which were part of this Aintab society. They were complaining about the following process. You know, we play a huge role in deporting and cleansing Armenians from the city of Aintab, but we didn't get what we deserve. The real fight, the real conflict among these local elites actually started after 1923, you know, when the entire Armenian community of the city was deported, forced to depart, of course. And they ended up in most of them in Aleppo and Syria and Lebanon. And after that, they start to fight for sharing, the properties and assets of Armenians.
Yeah, let me ask you another question, because wasn't there a moment after the defeat of the Ottoman Turks when Armenians in 1918-19 began to return, and did they return to Aintab and try to reclaim properties and then they lost them again?
Yes. So maybe I can take you through the content of the book with this question. So return process is one of the chapters within the book. So I explore how Aintab Armenians who managed to survive returned to their hometown starting December 1918. Of course, British occupation of the city play a huge role in this process, because the Armenians, Aintab Armenians who survived, they trusted and rely on the British, you know, forces, and they were convinced by them to come back. So they return to Aintab, and one of the first undertakings of British forces in the city was to start restitution process. institution process. And actually, this process was instigated in Ain Tap by British forces. And after British occupation, it was replaced with French occupation, and French forces accelerated this process as well. So there was this restitution process. There were also legal mechanism to strengthen the process itself. But local bureaucrats, the local authorities, were so reluctant to fulfill this restitution orders coming from the central government, you know. So this process started, continued, and came to a halt. And when the Kemalist national forces became the upper hand, and when there was a war between the nationalist forces and the French forces in the city from 1920 to 1921, you know, the Armenians sided with the French forces in Ain Tap War, Ain Tap Self-Defense, Ain Tap Koyamardı or Heresomardı. After, this process, this restitution process came to a halt when the war started. Actually, that was the one of the reasons why this Ain Tap War was started, because local elites who acquired most of these properties, they didn't want to give them away. That's why, in the first place, they were not willing to support Kemalist nationalist forces, which were arising in Ankara. When they saw that British forces and the French occupation forces, they were accelerating this, you know, restitution process, and they didn't want to, you know, give those properties back to their real owners. And then they decided to financially and logistically support the nationalist forces. And the war started afterwards. And the real fight among them started in terms of sharing the rest of the properties.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
That fight constitutes political lines in the city in 50s and 60s. Because when the Democrat Party was established in Turkey and won the election in 1950, those elites who believed that, you know, they were real fighters to evict the city out of their Armenians and, you know, and against the French forces and so forth, they thought they didn't get what they deserved, and then they became members of Democrat Party and start their political fight against their compatriots, who were also local elites of Ain Tap society, whom they thought acquire, you know, most of the properties more than they deserve.
Now, in this book, you're using Ain Tap, of course, as the locus for your research. But so this is something that could really serve as a model for research in so many other areas of the Ottoman Turkish Empire, right? In terms of the Armenian genocide. And some people are now doing such research. Is that right? In other areas?
Actually, it's a very important question. And that's why I consider my book not only a book about Armenian genocide, you know, or the economic plunder. In the book, I also explain and explore the Ottoman legal history about how to confiscate and liquidate these properties, how they created all these concocted ways of, you know, of robbing these properties, actually robbing the Armenians, robbing their properties and wealth under the veil of legality. So I also focus on the economic history of the Ottoman Empire, with a particular focus on Ain Tap, of course, particularly on the eve of war. What was the economic situation in the city? Armenian economic situation, Turkey and the Muslims part economic situation as well. So this work, I think, will enable other researchers to look into economic dispossession of minorities, first and foremost Armenians, Assyrians, and Ottoman Greeks, and how this process was carried out not only by the central authorities, but also the local collaborators, ordinary people, and what were their motivations. It also enables that kind, it opens up that kind of avenues for further research as well. So it's not only a history of genocide, which took place in Ain Tap, it's a history of Ottoman economic history, Ottoman legal history, with respect to the disposition of a society, of a group of people.
My guest today is Dr. Umit Kurt. He is the author of a new book called The Armenians of Aintab. We're going to take a brief pause on all things Armenian, and we'll be back in just a moment.
To All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlo Demirgardichian. I'm discussing a new book called The Armenians of Aintab, The Economics of Genocide in an Ottoman Province. It's been published by Harvard University Press. And its author is Dr. Umit Kurt, with whom I've been having a very interesting discussion. So, Umit, I want to ask you about the difference between your dissertation and the book. Can you tell us a little bit about the process of how you convert the dissertation to a book? And what's the major difference between the dissertation and the book? And tell us a little bit about that process.
So first of all, there's a practical aspect of it. In while writing your dissertation, you're a little bit bound up with your supervisor. So you have to satisfy your supervisor. So you don't have so much, you know, space or room to write, you know, your own, let's say, stand. Of course, you are making your argument, your own argument. You're also articulating your own standpoint. But still, you know, there are like certain rules and the boundaries within the dissertation. So first, the writing style is different, first of all. And also in the dissertation, you have that kind of liberty. You have the liberty of using all the materials, you know, you found in the archive. So in a book, you know, you have to really refine those sources. And And also, again, in the dissertation, another difference, you are usually, summarizing, documenting what the materials are about. And of course, you are putting also your own analysis and interpretation, but in the book, you should make it more and more. So you should really, really make an interpretation out of your sources rather than relying on the sources solely. You should also come up with your own interpretation of, or your own reconstruction of history on the basis of these documents, of course. As I said, writing style is different. And in the book also, I had to get rid of certain sections which were available in the dissertation, but not in the book, and especially the 19th century history of Ottoman Aintap Armenians in the city. I wrote a very comprehensive section about the economy, education, and also the whole 19th century politics within the city vis-a-vis Armenians and the Muslim community as well. So I try to refine this chapter, and I also got rid of so many materials from this chapter. And in the and also in the book, I decided to put, and I decided to also analyze Hamidi massacres which took place in the city in November 1895. It lasted 3 days. I not only zoom in on the massacres themselves, but I also explain how these massacres and why these massacres took place on that moment. So I try to also explain how the fault lines between these two communities were formed and taken shape by focusing on the 19th century Ottoman politics as well. You see, you know, all these Armenian reform discussions and Armenian political organization, formation of Armenian political organizations, Armenian modernization and nationalization process, let's say, and these kind of processes, I also analyze, resonate these events with the massacres and with the other chapters as well.
Were you able to expand in the book and add photographs and tables and those kinds of things? Can you tell us a little bit about that also in the book?
Yeah, I have used 15 images. I could have used more actually had I given the authority. But when you're working with university presses, you know, they are very strict and they have their limits. So I used 15 images, and those images were basically about the economic dispossession. You know, for instance, I have images regarding how Armenian neighborhood was destroyed, and how the materials and the assets were looted. And I also use certain images indicating showing Armenian buildings, hotels, or shops, and their current situation, or what these properties were transformed into in 50s and 60s. I use these kind of images too. And I have two maps actually, and I also have more than 8 to 10 tables. And all these tables are about how distribution of properties belonging to Armenians were carried out. So as I said, I determined, I pinpointed more than 400, locations and properties of Armenians and their original owner, first owner, and then the current owner. But I wasn't able to publish or put all these 450 locations, but I managed to put only 55 locations, but it gives you a general idea how the properties and also immobile properties especially were changed hands. These are unique kind of documentations actually in the literature. So for the first time, I'm showing how this process, how this despoliation and appropriation of a society and their wealth was carried out. both so-called legally and also on the ground, both looting, plundering, and also transactions of Aintab Liquidation Commission, which was a state institution, which was a governmental institution, how they sponsored this process of expropriation in the city.
And this is all in a new book called The Armenians of Aintab, The Economics of Genocide in an Ottoman Province. Boy, this is a project you've been actually living with for quite a few years now. So where do you go next? What are you thinking about for new research and new projects? Can you tell us about some of the things that you're working on?
Now, I have actually finished my second book. It was about, the book is about motivations of perpetrators during the Armenian genocide and their post-genocide careers, their life stories, their portraits of these perpetrators, their motivations as well. So I focus on the life stories of three guys, and I also made interviews with their relatives, their grandchildren. That is what I have done recently. So I try to indicate what motivations, what made ordinary Muslims, take part in this destruction process physically on the ground. So again, I'm focusing on Aintab as a particular case, and also exploring life stories of these three perpetrators, which you can put in three different categories. But of course, these categories are very hazy, very murky. So these are, one perpetrator can belong to both categories or not. So the boundaries are very porous within these categories, actually. So because the way they participated in the genocide or in the destruction process evolve over time. So, and change and vary from situation to situation. So I also try to explain their cognitive, dispositional, and situational motivations, the dynamics which made them active and direct perpetrator of the Armenian genocide.
And is this a book? This book is coming out soon?
Yes, I am planning to revise it a little bit more, because now the new researches and also books are being published about motivations of perpetrators, not regarding Armenian genocide, but in other mass violence events like Holocaust, Cambodia, and Rwanda. I want to also make use of this literature in order to enrich my conceptual framework. But the book is, tentatively over. My next project is about discussing the possibility of the idea of Ottomanism, idea of Ittihat-ı Anasır, Ottoman unity, and also the idea of impossibility of violence immediately aftermath of the Yom Tov Revolution in 1908, by dissecting an adult prostitution incident in a town called Adapazarı. So I'm trying to explore another adultery incident which took place in Adapazarı in February 1910. So I try to analyze why massacres which took place in Adana in April 1909 did not take place or could not take place in Adapazarı, because this prostitution incident, there was a district governor of Adapazarı, Sırrı Bey, and this guy tried to incite Muslim people to attack, Ottoman Armenians and Greeks in the town. So, but it didn't happen, because both Muslim and non-Muslim society or non-Muslim community of the town, Adapazarı, they came together, they met the half point, and they decided to secure and protect the constitutional regime and against a pro-CUP district governor, and sending a complaint letter about this guy to the Minister of Interior, asking them to send an inspector to investigate this guy in order to keep the regime intact. I try to analyze why the counterpart of Adana massacres did not take place in this town. The restraint of violence is my main theme in this work.
Sounds very interesting. My guest today has been Dr. Umit Kurt. He is the author of a new book available through Harvard University Press called The Armenians of Ayn Tab, The Economics of Genocide in an Ottoman Province. Umit, we look forward to you perhaps having coming to the United States in the fall so that you can come to Fresno and talk about your book and about your new projects.
I'm looking forward to it. You know, Fresno is always my second home, you know, first or second home. It doesn't matter. I don't see any difference, but I am infatuated with Fresno.
Thank you for joining us today. And for our upcoming events in the Armenian Studies program, on Saturday, March the 27th, Dr. Khatchig Muradyan will be presenting his new book called The Resistance Network, The Armenian Genocide and Humanitarianism in Ottoman Syria, 1915 to 1918. That will take place at 10 o'clock in the morning through Zoom, and you can get our link through our website or on Facebook. For All Things Armenian, this is Professor Barlow Demirgedichian wishing you a good week ahead, and we'll see you next week for another edition of All Things Armenian.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.